The middle and the end of this talk have changed a few times as I have thought about it these past months, but the beginning has always been the same. To the members of the Newbury Committee, I can only say that while my thank you may end with this speech, my gratitude never will. You have given me something I could never give myself. It is the most wonderful gift. It has done everything from bringing back old playmates to raising the eyebrows of my dry cleaner, who had previously thought me just another overcoat. I was talking to Maniac today, and he told me to tell you that he feels he now has 14 new moms and a dad. He says you're family. I feel the same. To my editor, John Keller, I have been grateful for about 10 years now. John took a chance on an unpublished author and brought into print Space Station 7th Grade. Several years ago, I called John and told him I had an idea for a story about a boy who has no home, no family, and doesn't go to school. I asked him if I could get away with such a thing. He didn't hesitate. Sure, he said, why not? Thank you again, John, for taking yet another chance. Also at Little Brown, I want to thank copy editor Betty Powers. The gentleness of her suggestions belies the sharpness of her vision. And Chris Paul, who designed the book and whose suggestion it was that the cover show simply a boy running. And photographic artist Carol Palmer, who made the simply perfect picture. And thank you to the best support group an author could have. Betsy Groban and Ann Quirk and Linda Magrum and Stephanie Owens Lurie. The Newbury Committee have come here from all over. Little Brown came from Boston. The others have come on the train with me. My wife and fellow author, Eileen, who says yes or no to every chapter, whose judgment I trust more than my own, and who creates the world in which I write. When the committee gave the award to me, they gave it to us. My mother and father, who have come from farther than Norristown, Pennsylvania, to be here tonight. And our agent, Ray Lincoln, and husband Jerry, the best of friends. They were thrilled to learn that Maniac McGee was dedicated to them. And this was long before the night of January 13th, 1991. I was doing what all respectable Pennsylvanians were doing at 12:30 a.m., a half hour after midnight. I was sleeping. How was I to know that the telephone's ring originated in Chicago, where it was only 11:30? Have you ever gotten good news at 12:30 a.m.? Neither had I. So why was I hurrying? I was hurrying to stop that infernal phone from ringing in the middle of the night. The phone is in the hallway. I leap up. I am in my underwear. In a flurry of modesty, I blindly grope for my bathrobe. Am I afraid a stranger has entered the house and is peeping from the top of the stairs? Do I fear the caller will sense my indecency? I grab the robe. It is dark. I am groggy. I cannot find the sleeve holes. It is 12:30 a.m., and the phone is ringing. Bathrobe in hand, I lurch into the hallway. Flick on the light, dive for the phone, kill the ringing, gird myself for the bad news, pray everyone's alive. Hello, I say. The voice that responds is unfamiliar to me. A doctor? The voice tells me its name is Alice Naylor. It says something like, "We want you to know that we have been very careful not to let the facts get mixed up with the truth." It says the word Newbury. The rest is fuzzy. I remember Eileen standing in the doorway. She tells me she thought she heard me say metal, M-E-T-A-L, and was wondering who might have gotten hit on the head with a metal something. I remember Alice Naylor saying she was standing amid a hotel room of committee members, all awaiting my witty reactions. I'm afraid I disappointed them. I'm not at my best in my underwear in the hallway in the middle of the night. I'm not even sure I had the presence of mind to say thank you to Alice Naylor. I certainly have since, several times, and I may yet once more. Perhaps some Sunday night, by phone, say, oh, around 12:30 a.m. So we say goodbye. We hang up. The screaming begins. Sean staggers bleary-eyed from his room and croaks, "What happened?" "We won the Newbury. we sing. He smiles sleepily, "Oh, congratulations," and goes back to bed. Ben never wakes up. We go downstairs. We talk, pace, giggle, drink Poland Spring water. At 4 a.m. we go back to bed. We sleep straight through to 4:15. At 7 we give up, go out to the Vale Rio Diner, have breakfast. I order French toast. I never get bacon. I get bacon. We come back home. We sleep till noon. And now again the phone starts ringing. This time there is no stopping it. Not long ago, a kid in a group I was speaking to raised his hand and said, "Where do you get all that stuff?" I looked out into a library full of cross-legged floor sitters, their eyes wide, mouths agape, all wondering the same thing, their classmate having put his finger on their second most pressing question. The first being, of course, how much money do you make? I pointed to them all, and I smiled, and I said, "You. You're where I get all that stuff." The expressions didn't change. They weren't buying it. "Look," I said, "what do you think I do? Make up all this stuff? I get it from you. I get it from the me that used to be you. From my own kids, your age mates. From my first two books, I didn't even have to look outside my own house." And I told them how I found Space Station 7th grade early one morning in my lunch bag, my fried chicken having been reduced to bones by one or more of the six sleeping angels upstairs. I told them that the warfare between Megamouth and Del Grosso in Who Put That Hair in My Toothbrush was nothing compared to the real battles between Molly and Jeffrey in my own house. I pointed to them again. "You're the funny ones. You're the fascinating ones. You're the elusive and inspiring and promising and heroic and maddening ones. Don't you know that?" I looked over the faces. No, for the most part, they did not know. And just as well. How regrettable if they did know, and thereby ceased to be themselves. The obvious prompting of her teacher notwithstanding, how could anyone but an unself-conscious sixth grader have written this? "Dear Mr. Spinelli, I am very sorry that I was playing tic-tac-toe while you were talking. I know that I had no right to it. I should have listened to you. It was positively mean and rude of me and my friend to play tic-tac-toe right under your nose. I regret it terribly, and I sincerely would understand if you hated me. I liked your talk and your books anyhow. If you do come back to Chatham, even after the rudeness of my friend and me, I hope that you get treated more kindly than this. Like I said before, I am really very, very sorry that I played tic-tac-toe instead of listening to you. Please do not unlike the school because of our terrible rudeness. With all our heart, we are sorry. Most sincerely, Katie Rose Loftus." Where do I get this stuff? I get it from Brooke Jacobs, who wrote, "When you came to our school, I thought I'd see a big, tall man in a suit looking rich. When I saw you, I got very relaxed." I get it from the young lady who wrote, "I will not say I totally enjoyed your talk, because that would be untrue. Mr. Spinelli, you are a great writer. However, you, in my eyes, do need to work on your group speaking skills." I get it from Nikki Holly, who wrote to me recently from Schuylkill Elementary, just a few blocks from my house. "I think no matter if people are black, white, or green, there is no difference in the way they get treated. It's the inside, not the outside." I get it from my old friend, who at the age of 9 months was left nameless on the doorstep of a judge of the Court of Common Pleas, a red cloth badge of the Sacred Heart pinned to his blanket. He was taken to a Catholic orphanage and there acquired the three names he answers to today, those of a judge, a nun, and a saint. He spent his first 17 years in this institution, called a home, and was thus known as a homie. Prospective foster parents were called friends. They would come to audition the orphans on Saturdays, a childhood of Saturdays past, and the sister's call went out to others, never him. "Hurry up now, your friend is waiting." Around the age of 7 or 8, my friend found himself among a busload of fellow homies streaming and chattering toward a swimming pool. There was a turnstile. Only one child admitted at a time. When my friend's turn came, a brawny hand clamped the metal pipe and held it still. It would not move. And my friend, who until then had known merely that he was black, discovered now that it made a difference. He does not know if the running began that day. He recalls only that he ran everywhere he went. He ran the 3 miles to Tony and Pete's hoagie hut, because if you were a homie, your hoagie from Tony and Pete's was free. He made that trip 2 or 3 times a week. The farthest he ran was 12 miles, 6 out and 6 back, to Bristol, where the nearest movie theater was. When he wasn't running to or from somewhere, he simply ran. That was the first patch in the quilt work that became Maniac McGee. There were many others. There were the summer afternoons on the Elmwood Park basketball court, myself the only white skin among 15 or 20 blacks. I remember a small, quiet feeling of gratitude, of pride, of admittance. There was no turnstile for me. There was Skag Cotman. I was barely 13 when he first became my baseball coach. He would pitch batting practice. Once to each player, he would throw his special pitch. He called it the stop ball. "It comes up to the plate all big and fat," he told us. "Then it stops and waits for you to swing. And then it goes on to the catcher's mitt." It was true. I know it was true, because none of us ever did more than whiff at, or at best graze, the stop ball. Several years later, a sophisticated 17-year-old, I dared him to throw me the old stop ball. He did. I creamed it. And for days thereafter, hated myself for growing up. There was the school in New York State several years ago. I had finished my talk in the library. Not a tic-tac-toe player in sight. And a teacher came up and said he wanted to introduce me to a particular sixth-grade girl. He said there was something very interesting about her. Every day, she carried her entire home library to school in a suitcase because she could not bear to abandon her beloved books to the crayons and sharp teeth of her siblings and pets at home. I met the girl and gave her my address and made her promise to write to me. She hasn't. I wish she would. I'm afraid she doesn't know that she became Amanda Beale in the book that won the Newbery. And there was Dr. Winters, my mother's dentist. She would take me along to his office on East Main Street. My own teeth were still too new to need repair, but I was jealous and the dentist was kind, so he would lift me into the chair and tilt it back and, with mirror and probe, pretend to examine me. To this day, I can feel his sure and sturdy fingers in my mouth. Cavities and an awareness that Dr. Winters was black arrived at about the same time, but by then we had moved. And now it is far too late to tell him that he became Amanda's mother. Maniac especially loved the warm brown of Mrs. Beale's thumb as it appeared from under the creamy white icing that she allowed him to lick away when she was frosting his favorite cake. Maniac McGee is, to my way of thinking, both the kid we all once were and the kids we now look after. He is us and ours, was and is. And insofar as he has no address, everywhere is home. Insofar as he belongs to no one, everyone is free to claim him. Where do I get this stuff? Let us recognize and celebrate the ones who really should be here tonight, the kids. Let's agree to a joint custody. When my kids are in your school or library, they're yours. When your kids are reading my book, or Avi's, or David McCauley's, or another author's, they're ours. And let us wish, let us urge this for them, that they seek their happiness not so much at the finish line as in the running, that they have the strength not to lift tremendous weights, but one fallen friend. that they learn to fight their own battles with a never-ending string of temporary ceasefires. Not that the occasion make them smile, but that their smile make the occasion. That their bridges be built not over rivers, but over misunderstanding. That their wealth be not in their banks, but in their hearts. That they gain power not over others, but over themselves. That they never fail to leave the stage before their applause is done. That they bow not to little people with big titles, but to big people with little titles. That their names be household words, not throughout the land, but in their own households. That their monuments be found not in public parks, but in the lives of those they have touched. And to all of you, my wish is for a gladness such as you have given me. Thank you.